Hello, you're listening to a podcast from the Institute for Research on Poverty at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Dave Chancellor. For this, our February 2016 podcast, I talked with Lincoln Groves, who's a postdoctoral fellow in the National Poverty Fellows Program that IRP runs in cooperation with two federal offices within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation, or ASPE, and the Office of Planning, Research, and Evaluation, or OPRE. Groves was at IRP in December of this past year and gave a seminar talk called Still Saving Babies, the Impact of Child Medicaid Expansions on High School Completion Rates, which was based on the dissertation he did at Syracuse University. Saving Babies is a reference to a 1996 paper by Janet Curry and Jonathan Gruber that looks at health outcomes associated with major changes in the Medicaid program between around 1980 and the early 90s that expanded eligibility for low-income children and pregnant moms. So when we started talking, I asked him about his shout-out to the Curry and Gruber paper and how that paper influenced his work.
I just looked out and said, wow, this is a really interesting research design. It's very clear. It's very creative. It's very, you know, this is the type of researcher I want to be, right? So, and I also love simulations. I like data work and things like that. And the things that they were doing were really cool. So kind of like as an intellectual challenging exercise, say, hey, let me see if I can replicate this, which at the time was a very naive exercise because it wasn't very easy to actually get all the data required to do that. So, you know, fortunately, in Syracuse, New York, there's long, cold winters, and you need to do something during those time periods. So I just started collecting all the data to do it. At the time, you know, we have, you know, trying to find our voices, researchers, and I was doing other different projects. So I was looking at high school dropouts just in general. So I kind of have the one side of the paper is very much a child investments, child Medicaid, thinking about health improvements. And then I had separate work looking at different outcomes in terms of graduation rates. And I was looking at things like impacts of No Child Left Behind. I was looking at exit exams, things like that. And I really wasn't finding large effects. So I just kind of had these two disparate topics. And I said, well, why don't I look at them together? And there's this early childhood investment thing. And I'm saying, well, this kind of makes sense. I can kind of see in the descriptive statistics, one's going up, the other one's going down in terms of access to care is going up for children. And the other one's going down in terms of the graduation dropout rates and graduation rates. Let me see how these are linked. And then I just kind of put the research design together and started pushing it forward there.
Grove says that in looking at the connection between child Medicaid receipt and graduation rates, that he was really asking a straightforward research question.
Do healthier children have better long-term outcomes? So that's all this is looking at. So as we look at different kind of levers and mechanisms by which the government can help facilitate improvements in long-run outcomes, health is a pretty obvious one.
What Curry and Gruber did in their paper and what Groves replicates in his paper is they look at variation in Medicaid eligibility to see how differences in one of government's big health policy levers over time and place might lead to different outcomes. So to understand this better, let's take a look at the basic history of how Medicaid eligibility for children worked.
Typically, Medicaid access was tied to the Aid to Families with Dependent Children program in the United States. And that was the cash assistance welfare program. So most people think of welfare, they think of actually AFDC back in the day. And it changed to TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, in the 1990s through welfare reform. But they just kind of bundled these projects together once upon a time. So Medicaid actually is a standalone program. It was part of President Johnson's Great Society program. And it just, because of the interesting nature of health insurance in the United States, there just wasn't necessarily an outlet for low-income individuals. So as part of the Great Society, they realized there was a gap in the market, and this was one way to fill that void. So they just naturally just kind of tied it also to another support program that had existed since the 1930s, which was AFDC, and just said, all right, well, if the mother, typically it was a single mother, qualifying for the program who had children, dependent children, and they would just do this all together.
But there were disadvantages to tying child Medicaid to AFDC. AFDC generosity often fluctuated and child Medicaid eligibility fluctuated with it. And since AFDC was mostly directed at single mothers with children, there were relatively large numbers of kids in two-parent married families with low income who weren't eligible for the health benefits. And because states were able to set their own eligibility criteria, there were remarkable differences in eligibility from state to state.
The example I remember is Alabama being in 1987 at 16% of the federal poverty line. So if you actually had an income, this is like a family of three, if you had an income that was 17% of the federal poverty line, boom, you're wealthy is the way that basically is what the legislator is saying. You don't necessarily qualify for the program. And then there would be other states like California is the example. I remember 109%. So they're well above it, right? So again, they had it tied for a while, and then legislators start thinking more about how do we improve access. And I think they generally wanted to do it, improve access to the program, knowing that there are benefits. It kind of also stemmed out of the United States had a very high infant mortality rate, which was very surprising for a Western nation. So there's this drive in the 80s to say, let's find ways to get healthier children. And part of that is extending care to the mother while she's pregnant. And then logically, there was this kind of extension through early childhood and then eventually through the entire childhood. So these decoupling, so they had federal mandates basically were saying, all right, you got to delink the programs. So child Medicaid can be its own standalone program. The child can qualify on their own. And you'll have these kind of dates by which you have to adopt, a federal poverty line threshold standard within your state. And states are choosing to do it at different times and also sometimes exceeding the minimum level set.
So Groves uses this variation in state-level eligibility for child Medicaid and links it up with the long-term outcome of high school graduation, as we mentioned before.
So basically, as we think about just identifying a graduation cohort, and we can easily just say on it, we make a couple, at least I do in my paper, make an assumption on average they graduated 18, right? And then I can back out when their birth year would have been. We'll just say it's 1981. And then we just kind of look at what were the state standards during that year, and kind of take this simulated sample, this nationally representative sample, and say, if all these children would have lived in that state, what percentage of the children would have qualified based upon that state's regulation at that point in time? And we do that for each individual year. So if it's going to be from conception through five, that's 7 years. That's 7 years, we're going to do that kind of march through that calculation of just kind of averaging these zeros and ones, or we do it throughout the entire time period from prenatal care all the way to age 17. So it really is just this kind of broad measure of, you know, how accessible was access to care for low-income children to get Medicaid insurance during the time that they were growing up.
For his results, Groves looks at two main measures, dropout rate and four-year high school graduation rate.
So there would be large decreases in the dropout rate, and then there are corresponding large increases in traditional four-year graduation rates. Unfortunately, the GED is an imperfect substitute, so it's not highly valued on the marketplace, and there's a large body, or at least a decent body of literature, which shows that GED holders don't make much more than high school dropouts, right? So we really, if we want to nudge and increase human capital development in the United States, it needs to be traditional diplomas. So in the paper, I try to put some meat on these statements in terms of the effects, in terms of the size. So I think some nice take-home points to think about are, I use this base of 3.8 million potential graduates in 2010. The paper outlines how exactly I get that number, but that's from data from the Common Core of data. And looking at the impacts on dropouts, there's over 200,000 less dropouts per year in that 2010 measure. And there's going to be correspondingly like 100,000 more graduates that can be directly tied to public health insurance access during childhood. And those are pretty substantial effects, I think.
I asked Groves what might be behind these effects that he's found, and he says there are two obvious areas that may be driving improved high school graduation among children who had Medicaid access.
It's just improved health, which just kind of makes sense, that the sense that children with access to health insurance will just be healthier, right? And the question is when does that occur? Is it early childhood? Is it while they're actually in high school, for example? Or is it someplace in between? So we think that as the child is in the seat more often, they're going to have benefits from that, right? Sick children miss a lot of days from school. There's just other issues, like before they even enter school, if they're just sick a lot, right? There's going to be decreases in cognitive development, non-cognitive development as well. So we just think that they might not be as prepared. And then also, quite frankly, there's an income effect. We know that money matters, right? Especially for low-income families, especially when it's just could be a couple of thousand of dollars. If you're not making that much as a family, not having to pay for things like especially the birth of the child, which can be very large for a family that doesn't have a lot of means, especially without insurance, or just having co-pays paid for or other doctor visits and things like that, that money can be reallocated to other things that could benefit the family in terms of the long-term trajectory of the child. The problem is we can't really disentangle those two effects at this point in time, not at least with the research design that I have and other ones that I've seen in the literature.
Groves says that his results, which echo those of the work of Curry and Gruber and those of other papers in the field that look at similar questions, point towards the importance of children's health as a basic policy issue.
to give low-income children the potential for opportunities in the United States, we should kind of take care of some basic measures. And public health is seemingly a kind of a lower bar one in terms of it needs to be addressed before they can start concentrating on higher level issues within their lives. So giving this access to low-income children, I think, is, you know, these papers are starting to show that there's tremendous long-term benefits, and I think that's very important, especially as we look at today with, you know, the ACA debates, right? So part of this contention is there's short-run costs that the states are going to absorb, and that makes certain, you know, policymakers or certain individuals uncomfortable because it's increasing the size of government. But as we think about, you know, the long-term benefits, right? So we have a social welfare system here in the United States, which is pretty large. Let's just be honest about it, right? And yes, we don't want to waste money, but if we're finding ways that can increase human capital in the long run, it makes these people, in theory, less dependent on public support programs as adults, more likely to be taxpayers, and then they're paying back essentially the government. So it's really, I like thinking about this as like a human capital investment story.
Thanks to Lincoln Groves for sharing his work with us. You've been listening to a podcast from the Institute for Research on Poverty.